Question of the day on News Talk 580 CFRA.
Welcome back to Ottawa Work. It is time for our question of the day. Are you concerned with the state of healthcare in our province? How is it affecting you? Do you think we've learned any lessons from the ongoing pandemic? Text us at 580-580. Tweet us at CFRA Ottawa. Chatting about continuing staffing shortages across this province, across the country, actually, in terms of ERs dealing with burnt out staff, as well as other issues like a COVID-19 outbreak at the Perth and Smiths Falls District Hospital. Lots of questions about staffing in the future here, particularly as we're dealing with a coming summer wave, many are predicting, of COVID-19, or a wavelet, as some have called it as well. And then the fall, the regular respiratory virus season, where we'll see an uptick anyway of regular viruses as well. Are we prepared? Have we learned anything at this point? Text us 580-580. Tweet us at CFRA Ottawa. I spoke to President and CEO at Perth and Smiths Falls District Hospital, Michael Cohen, about the ongoing staffing issues. He says that this is a crisis facing the entire healthcare industry.
Learning that staff testing positive brought our very fragile staffing situation into a state of collapse. And as a result, unfortunately, we're going to be closing our emergency services.
He's calling it the staffing issue across the province. He says that any CEO or president of a hospital will tell you that staffing is the number one issue right now. And we did ask the health minister last week for an interview on this once again this morning. No response so far this morning. We got a statement last week about pre-existing investments in the budget in the healthcare system since 2020. But it looks like no acute kind of plan right now to deal with some of these issues that are facing the healthcare system, including staffing. And, you know, it takes time to get staffing, get trained, get everybody up to go. So, you know, it sounds like we're even further away from that. At this point, what can we do other than speed up hiring in that front? How is the health system affecting you? Texas 580-580. Tweet us at CFRA Ottawa. Text here says, my wife has been waiting for permanent implant surgery after cancer treatment since April 2021. And as we deal with more delays in the hospital system and staffing issues as well, we saw it during the pandemic. It's those quote-unquote non-essential surgeries that are the first to be cut. And, you know, you talk to somebody who has recurring knee problems that can barely walk, or someone with a shoulder issue that has, you know, no quality of life or is in pain all the time, they don't consider that non-essential. So those are kind of the things that start to go when we get the healthcare system in a pinch like this. But as John Kirby mentioned last half hour, the pandemic has shown that, you know, this decay has been going on for years. I guess it's just a matter of how do we address it? And, you know, it's great to see the gas tax cut happening for drivers. You know, that 5 cents a liter, every little bit helps, it adds up, I know, but that revenue of $300 million over that, it's being lost this year. It goes along with the license plate stickers, right? I know we all are very happy not to be paying that as well, but where is this revenue going to come from? You know, personally, I don't know. I'd rather the government keep the 5.7 cents a liter and put that money into our healthcare system that's clearly hurting right now. That's just me. But it's tough, and it looks like it's going to be a tough time down the horizon for our healthcare system, even more than it's already been the last couple of years. Another text here, I'm concerned that Ford hasn't said a thing about the current situation, especially the closures. This will affect us for years. It needs to take action now and ensure that nurses are fairly paid. The other thing we're kind of seeing is healthcare workers upset over Bill 124, which has legislated them to a 1% raise, pay raise. They are not happy about that, particularly when we see inflation at an all-time high, 1%, not exactly doing anything for anybody on that front. And this bill was supposed to be in effect for a few years to get us out of the deficit. Looks like it's continuing on. No word on any repeals of that from the Ford government at this point, so that's also an issue here as well. And then just an issue of doctor staffing as well, doctor recruitment across Ontario and Canada as well. especially in rural areas, as they're continuing to stay open because of that lack of staff. Now, former president of the Canadian Medical Association, Dr. Ann Collins, believes there is a way to relieve some of this pressure.
Addressing the need for pan-Canadian licensure, which means that if you're licensed in one province as a doctor, you can practice in other provinces, so that relief can be given if someone has an opportunity to go to a rural or remote community. And we've heard from physicians that they would do that if they didn't have to go through licensing routes.
Dr. Collins saying it's not just the provincial government that could help in this situation. The feds can also do their part.
Let's get some federal commitment here to say, how can we do this more quickly and more efficiently so that if there are individuals that will meet the needs of Canadians and our healthcare systems, let's get them working. And the same for internationally educated nurses.
As she adds, the medical system has not changed enough to entice new doctors on the whole, or to rural areas.
Our needs are entirely different on the patient end of the spectrum, but also on the practitioner end of the spectrum. So we need to resolve that and make it more desirable for people to choose, for example, family medicine, and to give them that support that they need to feel fulfilled and not burnt out in the practice.
It's Dr. Ann Collins, former president of the Canadian Medical Association, chatting about some of the concerns with staffing, saying that we need to kind of integrate all of our healthcare systems to allow workers to transfer easily between the provinces. I know that would be welcome for many provinces struggling with healthcare workers. And to just think right now, as well as we look at this as a whole across the country, Ontario is one of the beacons, right? In terms of salaries and positions and things like that. So if we're hurting this badly, and if rural Ontario is hurting badly, imagine what it's like in, you know, Saskatchewan, rural Saskatchewan, or, you know, northern Nova Scotia towards Cape Breton, some of these rural areas. Very difficult. We're seeing it in our rural areas, right? Down Perth and Smiths Falls, Kingston over the weekend, as we mentioned as well. So it's definitely affecting everyone, not just across the province, across the country as well. And just concerned that with a possible coming wave, even with the regular flu season, that we're going to be setting ourselves up for a difficult fall here when we could be doing, you know, a little more planning or addressing issues right now. Even, for example, talking to Ray Watt-Dianandan the other day, epidemiologist here at the University of Ottawa, sees no reason why we can't open up the fourth dose of COVID-19 dose vaccine eligibility to this point. Because, one, what's it hurting? And if everybody gets a fourth dose, or a bunch of people get a fourth dose before the fall and they're more protected, what does it matter? And he says, oh, well, you know, the variants, people will say the variants are changing. What's the point of getting a fourth dose if it's just going to change? Well, the variants are always changing. They're changing every day. Even this most recent booster, you know, isn't likely going to be enough to keep up with the latest variant. He said the goal eventually is to have a pan-coronavirus vaccine. That would be the goal eventually. But to try to keep our healthcare system protected to this point, it does really seem to make a lot of sense just to open up the fourth doses of COVID-19 vaccines. Just one way we could try to help with that. But your thoughts on this? Text us 580-580, tweet us at CFRA Ottawa. Are you concerned about the state of our healthcare system right now as we deal with shortages and some ER closures in places as well? And checking in on how the delays in the healthcare system are affecting you. You can text us at 580-580. You can tweet us at CFRA Ottawa, and we'll take those texts coming up throughout the rest of the show. Still to come as well here on the show, we'll chat a little bit more about the economy. Inflation is really hurting Canadians, obviously. The Bank of Canada expected to raise interest rates later this month, July 14th, in fact, so that's next week. And it's expected to push us into a recession at some point this year. Moshelander is a lecturer in economics at Concordia University. He's going to join us to chat about that coming up at the 10 o'clock hour as well. Also, how feasible is it for travelers to make that travel plan work for this summer, given the amount of canceled flights, baggage delays, other delays happening at Pearson and other airports across the country? Elliot Finkelman is a local travel expert. He's going to chat with us about that. Also talk about Ukraine, extremism within the Canadian forces, and other issues coming up over the course of next 2 hours, two and a bit. This is Ottawa at Work on News Talk 580 CFRA. I'm Andrew Pinson. We're with you until noon today. Turn up the music. Turn down the lights. I got a feeling.
You're listening to Ottawa at Work on News Talk 580 CFRA.
9:50. This is Ottawa at Work. We've been chatting about the state of our healthcare system. Just wanted to get to a text here from Kaylin in Carleton Place. My 1.5-year-old has been sick with a fever since Saturday. The pediatrician won't see her because she has a fever. Online appointment suggested the CHEO clinic. Booked an appointment for this morning. We get there, there's no doctors available. 3 days off of work trying to get my daughter to see a doctor, trying to avoid blocking up the emergency room. But now it looks like my only option. And sorry that you're dealing with that, Kaylin. Just more stories of what people are dealing with in our healthcare system right now with delays, staffing issues as well. Let us know what you think. Text us 580-580, tweet us at CFRA Ottawa, as well as what you're dealing with when it comes to healthcare at this point. And sticking with healthcare as well, many people have seen the pain caused by opioids anecdotally with family or friends, which, of course, is ironic concerning, you know, they're supposed to ease our pain. A new study at McGill University has found that opioids could be doing more harm to us than good when recovering from major surgery, and they're still being prescribed at high rates to patients. Dr. Giulio Fiore Jr. was a co-author on this study. He's an assistant professor at McGill University, a scientist at the Research Institute at McGill. Good morning, Dr. Fiore.
Good morning. Nice talking to you.
And thanks so much for your time today. Just, you know, why are we still prescribing opioids when we know the inherent dangers? Let's just start there.
The reasons contributing to the widespread use of opioids in North America are really multifactorial and includes, of course, like false advertisement by pharma companies, especially in the 1990s and 2000s regarding the effectiveness and safety of opioids. And also clinicians in North America in general, they are highly concerned that like not prescribing opioids to treat post-operative pain will lead to patients like complaining of uncontrolled pain and being dissatisfied with the treatment that they're receiving. And also there is a widespread belief by doctors that patients who are not treated with opioids, they might like come back to the hospital or to a clinic due to uncontrolled pain, causing an unnecessary burden to the system. But the findings from our study indicate actually that none of these concerns are supported by evidence, because the randomized controlled trials that we identified actually found that treating patients without opioids, patients do just fine.
You know, some of the more common ones we're talking about here, it's oxycodone, hydromorphone, tramadol, codeine. But just in terms of the levels of prescriptions, have we seen them taper off over the, you mentioned, you know, pretty high in the 90s, we're seeing advertisements and things like that. Have we seen them taper off at least the more that we've seen some of the damages caused here?
I believe so, especially in the past few years. I don't think there is much research done in Canada about that, or at least I'm not aware. But numbers from the United States show that the number of opioid prescriptions has been like reducing like in the past few years, especially with like new guidelines, especially from the United States, like encouraging physicians to prescribe less opioids than they used to.
And how have they been doing just in terms of helping the patient? How have you seen them, based on your research, how have you been seeing them do more harm than good in some cases while people are recovering from major surgery?
Yeah, what our research found is that, like, surprisingly, when we combine the results from different studies looking at opioids versus opioid-free analgesia after surgery, the prescription of opioids did not reduce pain reported by patients, but very importantly, the use of opioids considerably increased the risk of adverse events such as nausea, dizziness, and constipation. And these are side effects that are very uncomfortable for patients recovering from surgery. And this is the first time that the results from previous studies have been, like, combined and analyzed together. So this work really bridges a critical knowledge gap.
And we talk about, you know, some of the issues and some of the pitfalls of opioids. We've seen them kind of play out. Do you think they can still serve, though, an important role for helping patients recover? Or do we need to kind of do more to look at alternate kind of paths of medicine?
Like, what our research shows that for certain types of surgeries, for example, surgery of minor or moderate extent, when I talk about minor surgeries, I'm talking about dental procedures or procedures involving small joints of hands and feet. Like, these are procedures that are usually done in a clinic. And moderate procedures are like appendectomies, gallbladder removals, and minor orthopedic surgeries. For these types of surgeries, our research supports that clinicians can safely prescribe only non-opioid drugs, and patients will do just fine. But we did not identify any studies focused on more like extensive procedures such as cardiac surgery, lung resections, transplant of major organs. So for these type of surgeries, we still not have evidence about what's the best way to manage pain for these patients.
And just in terms of, I know this study particularly wasn't looking at this, but is there a concern that, I guess, starting patients on a regimen of opioids could lead them to the black market? For example, we've seen an increase in you know, opioid deaths on the street from tainted street drugs. Those aren't the same. But, you know, if someone is addicted to opioids or making that first stop at the doctor or their first introduction to opioid painkillers at the doctor, is there a concern that that could bleed over into the black market and cause other, obviously, health outcomes?
Like, this is not a major concern for surgical patients specifically, because most of the patients that will, like, go into surgery, they are, like, opioid naive. They never received an opioid prescription in their life. So it's unlikely that these patients will go to the black market because their surgeons did not prescribe opioids to them. But on the other hand, this is a major concern for patients with chronic pain, the ones that already are using opioids, but the clinicians decide that like opioids is not the best option for them and try to start like tapering off the amount of opioids that patients are taking. So the risk of going to the black markets are more focused on patients of chronic pain rather than surgical patients.
And just we've heard even in the last few weeks, we saw Purdue Pharma Canada reach a settlement here with the federal government in terms of some of the healthcare costs related to the sale and marketing of opioid medications as well. We saw similar things south of the border as well with Purdue as well. Do you anticipate that we are going to see, I guess, these drug makers face some additional accountability based on what's kind of played out with some of these issues with opioids and addiction?
I think they should be made accountable, and I think they are being made accountable already, like in the U.S. and now like in Canada. Mm-hmm. And I think this is a great thing. And like, even if you look in the internet, like on YouTube, like different videos of like how opioids were advertised in the 1990s and 2000s, like things were just like insane. And especially like, it was clear like false advertisement in terms, especially of the safety of these drugs. And now we know that for most cases, these drugs are not like safe at all and should be really prescribed in a controlled manner. And what we're finding, especially for surgical patients, is that like many patients do not benefit from being prescribed opioids.
Yeah, and that knowledge is a lot of power for sure for everyone out there. And Dr. Giulio, thank you so much for your time this morning. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you. It's Dr. Giulio Fiore Jr., assistant professor at McGill University, a scientist at its research institute at the McGill University Health Center. Just interesting to see the plight of opioids continue. I was mentioning Purdue Pharma Canada just reaching a settlement with the federal government for $150 million. That just happening last month. So the pharma companies are starting to, as Dr. Fiore mentioned, take some accountability for some of the issues that we've seen with extensive over-prescribing of opioids in this country and south of the border. I'm going to take a quick break here for the news. Moj Lander is an economist. He's going to join us next to talk about sky-high inflation that all Canadians are dealing with now. We're also talking about the healthcare system this morning. Your concerns, how are delays affecting your dealings with the healthcare system? Text us 580-580. Tweet us at CFRE Ottawa. We'll be right back after the news. 10:06. This is Ottawa at Work. Thanks so much for joining us here on News Talk 580 CFRA. I'm Andrew Pinsent with you until noon today. We've been talking about inflation. It is sky high. It's at record costs or record highs. It's making everything cost more for consumers. A new report this week also saying that pending interest rate hikes are likely to push us into a recession. Finance Minister addressing this yesterday saying that Canada is well positioned within the G7 to deal with a coming recession, if it were to come with that. Joining us to talk about that this morning is Moj Lander. He's senior lecturer in economics at Concordia University. Good morning, Moj.
Good morning.
And thanks so much for joining us. Just, we've talked about this before, just in terms of headed to that dreaded R word, When it comes to what consumers are dealing with right now, at the end of the day, does that word recession, or does that actually mean anything? Will it change anything for Canadian consumers?
Not really. The idea of a recession is a technical term anyway. So whether we actually have one or not, it's not going to affect individual Canadians in a particular way. It's merely a matter of, if you feel that things are going south for you, you need to change your behavior, right? It's not that because the economy is in a recession, you have to. It's your personal financial situation that dictates that.
And Canadians obviously have been calling for government to do something to help with some of these high costs and rising costs and what have you. But listening to the finance minister yesterday saying, you know, we're well set up to kind of deal with this impending economic uncertainty. Do you think that's the federal government signaling that, you know, we're hoping here until the end of the year?
Well, you know, here's the crazy thing. If we're looking to the government to do something about the high inflation, the correct thing to do is actually for the government to spend less, not more. But if we go into a recession, the correct thing for the government to do is spend more, not less. So the government's in an impossible position here. And that's exactly the situation that we find ourselves in, is a once in a generation situation that economists call stagflation. We have a stagnating economy with high inflation. And so the Bank of Canada is in the same position, that if they try to address one of the problems, they exacerbate the other problem. And if they try and deal with one problem, then they exacerbate the other. So they're both in impossible positions right now in deciding which one of these is the more critical issue that needs to be addressed.
And just wanted to pick up on a couple of things you said. Just, is there any spending in your mind that the government could do that will help ease inflation at this point?
So what the government can do if they want to spend is, what they really should be doing is reallocating the way that they're spending. So, you know, if they wanted to say, for example, reduce defense spending and increase their spending on those at risk of inflation, right? Low income Canadians, those on fixed incomes and things like that, then it's not actually adding to spending in the economy, but it's reallocating in a way to help those that need it. That would be okay. But if they're going to come up with new spending plans, remember the finance minister last month said that there was $8.9 billion worth of new spending coming. That's exactly the wrong thing to do. And that's why the number was so small. They understand that's the small number or the wrong thing to do. But rather than say they're doing nothing, they at least just threw a couple of crumbs to keep us off the scent that the correct thing to do is, in fact, no spending.
Well, and you mentioned stagflation, too. It's an interesting part of this, because earlier in the spring, we saw job numbers and GDP numbers. They were looking pretty good, but they've sputtered somewhat since then. So I guess what, from your read, is keeping the economy from, I guess, growing right now?
It's 2 years of COVID created a lot of imbalances, and an unbalanced economy is never a good thing. It needs to rebalance itself. It needs to correct itself. And so what happened was, when COVID restrictions were being eased and people had this resentment of 2 years of lost time, everybody just quickly wanted to make up for it by binging on whatever it is that they could. But the realization was that 2 years of working from home and not having stable jobs and a lot of economic uncertainty built up a lot of debt within Canadian households. And so the realization that, you know, the curb payments are stopping, we're over indebted, the correction is coming now, and that rebalancing is coming now. So that's really where we find ourselves now. And so the early recovery was probably more illusory than it was some sort of real indication that we came out of COVID unscathed.
Well, and you know, we're talking about this, and we're talking about this every day. So I know that has an impact as well. Is there a kind of a lack of consumer confidence right now in terms of there's more of a willingness to save that extra money rather than spend it right now?
Yeah, and psychology is going to be important if there is a recession that's coming, right? If we realize that this is just a chance to rebalance the economy, then it will hopefully be short-lived. If we think that this is some sort of crisis that is going to affect us for decades to come, it's the type of thing that makes things last longer. It's exactly the sort of idea that, you know, you stay up on a weekend and have a little bit too much fun. You need the Sunday to recover. There's nothing wrong with the recovery. It's in fact welcome. And psychologically, we understand that as part of our day-to-day lives. If we kind of view that the economy has had a little bit too much fun on the weekend and now needs a Sunday to recover, we're better able to handle that. And we accept that that's just what needs to be done right now. If we view this as something that came out of nowhere, that's the thing that becomes the problem.
That's how you make economics relate to people, for sure. Just in terms of the Bank of Canada, we've seen, you know, it takes some criticism. It is trying to kind of ease some of this inflation by rising interest rates, but some people are arguing these are rising too quickly for people to deal with. Just your thoughts on how the Bank of Canada has been managing this situation over the course of this year so far.
So I'm going to defend the Bank of Canada here. The interest rates probably should have increased a little bit earlier than what they did. But again, I guess to use a bad analogy, when the Canadian economy was suffering through COVID and the worst restrictions and the lockdowns over the last 2 years, we basically had a dying patient. The Canadian economy was dying on the table. And, you know, somebody in the medical profession can correct me if I'm wrong, but when you have a patient that's dying on the table, you pretty much do whatever you need to just keep them alive. Once you have them stabilized, that's when you start figuring out, now how do we improve their quality of life? You don't try and improve their quality of life when they're dying. It's just get them through. And so that's what the Bank of Canada was doing. They allowed interest rates to be low for an extended period of time, even though they understood that there was an inflationary impact to what they were doing, merely to keep the Canadian economy alive. Now that it's showing signs of stability, life, and that there's a future ahead, now's the time when you start figuring out, how do we improve the quality of life? And so, you know, they need to make up for the interest rates that should have been increased probably late last year, but they allowed to slide. And so it's almost like they're making up for lost time now.
It almost appears that perhaps they've waited too long to this point, and that's why we're seeing, I guess, some of the more major impacts, I guess, quicker impacts.
Yeah, and that's exactly it. And so, you know, inflation got unleashed, not just because of things within the Canadian economy. Like if you remember last year, the government had a deficit of $350 billion, right? Like that's inflationary. But it's also things that are outside of their control, right? The Bank of Canada has no influence over what's going on in Ukraine. The Bank of Canada has no influence over lockdowns that are still ongoing in China or supply chain disruptions. So all they can do is react to what they see. Even if they can anticipate some of it, sometimes you need to wait for the actual action to take place rather than speculating. Now, speculation can be a bad thing when you start increasing interest rates, because if people don't understand why they're doing it, that leads to uncertainty and that leads to more economic instability. If everybody can say, hey, there's inflation, and everybody understands that high inflation means high interest rates, then at least we understand what they're doing, even if we don't necessarily like it.
Or if it ends up hurting us at the end of the day. But we'll leave it there. Moshe, thanks so much for your time. I always appreciate it.
Anytime.
You're listening to Ottawa at Work on News Talk 580 CFRA.
Oh, 10:22, this is Ottawa at Work. Thanks for joining us on this Wednesday morning. Beautiful day in the nation's capital. We're chatting a lot about travel delays, Canadians facing many of them, as well as other headaches as they travel across the country for the first time in a couple of years without COVID-19 restrictions. But, you know, how feasible is it for travelers to make that plan or flight or connecting flight work? Elliot Finkelman is a local travel expert, the author of Pack Your Best Attitude First. He joins us on the line this morning. Elliot, good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Not too bad. What are you hearing just in terms of some of the issues with travel delays?
You know, there are delays. There is no arguing that, no question about it. I do want to remind people, though, that and I don't know the exact percentage, but most luggage is going, is going through. Most travelers are getting where they're wanting to go. It's that delay in the middle, and that's really getting a lot of people upset. There's lots of blame to go around. You know, the customs offices, the passport office, which the passport, and I don't know the technicalities of it. I'm not sure why they didn't say to everybody who needs an updated passport, here, we're just going to stamp it good for another 6 months and come back when we got some of this mess cleaned up. But I think it all goes back to the planning ahead, knowing what you're going to get into, then you'll be okay. I've had the luck of being able to travel pretty consistently through, at least since last November. And I've had both sides of the experience. I missed a flight, a connector in Toronto, a couple of months back and had to stay overnight. However, I can tell you that about 4 weeks ago, I came back from Europe and got from my European flight to my connector in 22 minutes through customs.
That's a record on a good day.
Yeah, yeah. And I think this is what we're hearing. There's a lot of, wow, that's not so bad. And then we're hearing the other stories where people are just lined up for a couple of hours. So I think being prepared, and if we all do our part, we're going to help maybe with some of those areas, realizing that the airports, you know, it's a perfect storm, right? If you really think about this, the airports, they had laid off staff. The airlines, they had laid off staff. You know, all the way through the system, CATSA, the security people. Now you've got to bring people back on. It's not as simple as just hiring these people either. Remember, even your baggage handler has got to go through some security checks. They're working airside. You don't want just anybody on that other side of that, you know, the door. So, and the training that they have to go through. So it's going to take time to ramp up. So how can you as a traveler, because we're all dying to get out there and go and do something, still get out there and enjoy it? And I've got a few tips, you know, if we've got the time to go through a few of them.
Yeah, absolutely. I just wanted to ask you just in terms of the passport offices, that is the most logical thing I have heard in this entire debate is just that 6-month stamp passport.
Yeah.
But just we saw the federal government order 800 chairs to kind of deal with this. Does that kind of indicate to you that this is going to continue on for some time?
It sounds like it is as far as the passport. So that's, again, you know, being prepared. If you know your passport's going to be expiring in 8 months or 10 months, even if you don't think you're traveling, go get one. Go do it. Do it now so that you're not in that mad panic. We're seeing some, you know, again, this isn't the majority of people, but we are seeing some people that are waiting. You know, you've got a countdown for some of them on the air, you know. A long time to get their passport. Also, really double check the information you're sending in. I think that's where the consumer, we can help ourselves. A lot of times the passport office will tell you, well, that form wasn't filled in quite right, or this wasn't backed up by this document. So you really need to double check your work all the time. And yes, the passport thing may be a problem, but most of us have 10-year passports, minimum 5-year. Look at your passport today. Don't assume you're not traveling in the next bit and go get it updated now, right? So you don't have to worry about it so much.
Yeah, I'm the lucky few that luckily did just get it done just before the pandemic. So
right.
Have that sitting in the background. But as you were talking about, just like in terms of tips for, I guess, travelers and booking flights, we're hearing about, you know, missed connections and things like that.
Yeah. So
just in terms of preparing for that, how best to do that?
So first of all, if you can avoid a layover, I was never a fan of driving to Montreal to get a flight because why wouldn't I let a pilot fly me and blah, 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 and all those things. But right now I'm suggesting, you know what? Maybe it's not a bad idea. Go the night before, extend your holiday by one night, stay in a hotel nearby the airport. That way you're there early in the morning and you're ready to go. You don't have to worry about traffic. You don't have to worry about a delay coming out of Ottawa, for example. If you have to have a connector, two things. Get to the airport early. Despite the fact that, oh, it's just a little short flight to Ottawa, I can show up an hour ahead. Don't. Show up 2.5 hours ahead. Show up 2 hours. Learn to relax at the airport with your significant other or whoever you're traveling with or a good book. Bring your iPad, whatever you need to do. It's free Wi-Fi at the airport. And just chill and relax at the airport. Don't do it last minute at home. So be prepared for that longer wait. And you may get surprised. You may not have to worry about it, okay? Packing, I've always had a tip that says pack in 2 separate bags and pack, you know, I will take half of my wife's stuff and let her take half of my stuff, right? That way, if one bag goes astray, it's okay. We still have enough stuff to go with. A lot of people are only doing carry-on right now and then buying themselves some presents at the other end. Don't forget when you get one thing that would speed up a lot, I really think, because if you think of the long line of, if you've got 100 people at security, and if every one of us could shave 30 seconds off of our time there or a minute, think of how that would help us, right?
That's
so
true.
Don't wear your belt, okay? Wear clothes that you don't need a belt. Don't wear boots that need to be done up and undone. Take off all that jewelry. You don't need to fly with it. You know, put that watch in your pocket. You don't need all that stuff right now. Make sure that if you have to bring a laptop, that it's ready to be taken out instantly and that it's charged up and ready to go. Don't forget to and I'm going quickly because I'm watching the clock here.
Me too, don't worry.
And but I could go on. I could go on.
Of course.
Lots of tips. And don't forget to, again, charge it. I would bring paper backup of everything as well. Because, you know, you're standing in line and you're watching somebody try and flip through their phone to find something where somebody else just goes, here's the piece of paper, I can't find it on my phone. So it's all about being prepared. You know, if you've got an exam the next day, don't study the night before. You start earlier. Get everything all laid out. Don't pack last minute. Be ready to go. Bring snacks with you so that if you're stuck in the airport, some of the lineups just at Starbucks go for miles, you know.
Yeah.
Bring your own snacks.
And all of these definitely make sense, and particularly the paper aspect as well, because, you know, even sometimes our phones are dead at the most inconvenient times as well.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. But like I say, the good news is most guests are getting where they're going. Again, it's a little bit of delay. It's a little bit of and for some, it's a lot of inconvenience. I get it. You're traveling with kids. It's not easy. But the reward at the other end is that wonderful holiday, that getaway, the time seeing family that you haven't seen in a long time. Just prepare, plan, use a travel professional. Yes, that's a bit self-serving, but I'm telling you, they can give you a lot of tips and save you a lot of hassles.
You're saying pack your best attitude first. That's what you're saying, Elliot.
Always. You like that one.
Yeah, thanks so much for your time, Elliot. I really appreciate it, and thanks for the very valuable tips.
Thanks, Andrew, and thanks for letting us get out some of these tips to the consumers.
Take care. It's Elliot Finkelman, a local travel expert, author of Pack Your Best Attitude First, just giving us some travel tips, how to deal with some of these delays right now in all facets of the travel industry. Chris Holsky standing by with your news. Coming up next on the other side, we'll chat more about Ukraine as the Russians have continued their advance on one pivotal Ukrainian city. Kyiv says the fight is ongoing. We'll talk about that with Jean-Francois Rattel coming up after the break. This is Ottawa at Work.
You're listening to Ottawa at Work on News Talk 580 CFRA.
10:36. This is Ottawa at Work. I'm Andrew Pinson with you until noon today. Still to come on the show, chatting more about our healthcare system, how it's affecting you. Text us your thoughts, 580-580. Tweet us at CFRA Ottawa. This is, we're seeing emergency room closures happening in Perth, in Kingston, in other places as well. Staffing shortages, the name of the game at this point. Also some COVID-19 outbreaks. But how is the health system affecting you, some of these delays? We've been hearing about this morning some delayed surgeries and other kind of issues as well. Issues with kids, trying to get them into the pediatrician as well. Your thoughts on that? What are you dealing with? Text us 580-580. You can tweet us at CFRA Ottawa. 10:37, NATO nations are signing protocols for Sweden and Finland to join the NATO alliance. This as the continuing invasion of Ukraine goes on by Russia, and more concerns about control of the country as well. Joining us to talk about all of that is Jean-Francois Rattel. He's a military expert and assistant professor in the University of Ottawa's Faculty of Social Sciences. Good morning, Jean-Francois.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
And thanks so much for joining us this morning. We did see Canada, one of the first, I guess, countries to welcome NATO or Finland and Sweden to the NATO alliance yesterday. Just your thoughts on welcoming two new members to the NATO alliance.
Well, I think it's showing how the war in Ukraine and the Russian invasion of Ukraine has created some sort of tension and fear inside of non-aligned country like Sweden and Finland. And for the moment, Sweden and Finland are joining the alliance. It's not really threatening Russia. However, Russia is perceiving it as a step further toward their own border, making Russia trying to press for more, to press the alliance and NATO in order for them to stop where they are, their expansion so far.
And we've also seen, we saw the two-day NATO summit last week in Madrid, where Jens Stoltenberg again kind of asking members to do their part to give that 2%, if not more, in terms of military spending to help the alliance as well. Just, you mentioned how the invasion of Ukraine has kind of changed the calculus in some ways. In some ways, has it brought, you know, the NATO alliance a little bit closer together after some years of divisiveness?
That certainly brought them a lot more together. I think Russia did more to bring the alliance together than any country within the alliance in the last 40 or 50 years. We can see it like that. At the same time, we also see that in the discussion last week, there was the idea of increasing the rapid response forces of the alliance in order to react to any potential threat from Russia, but also from Belarus or other countries. For the first time, NATO has mentioned that China can represent a competitor at the international level. So we're seeing the alliance being ready for a broader perspective of risk and getting together much more cohesively with regard to Ukraine and other threats.
And just with that cohesiveness, how do you see, the likes of Russia or China or Iran reacting to that in terms of seeing that cohesion come together and the kind of world reaction to this? Because it doesn't feel like many expected this type of reaction.
For the moment, we don't think that it would change much with regard to Russia or China getting closer to each other or even with Iran. But at the same time, it certainly affects the way Russia and China is perceiving the West, because the West has also mentioned that they want to expand the influence of NATO in the Pacific region. So we're seeing that slowly but surely there is much more geopolitical concerns with regard to how our NATO and other countries are perceiving, let's call it a competition between major power in the world.
And just on the ground, we're hearing Russia's claiming victory in Luhansk. It's trying to continue to capture the entire Donbass. That's kind of its goal. But we've kind of went into a grinding war of attrition here. So do you think it stops at that? Do you think if Putin were to seize the entire Donbass region, that the war would be over?
We don't know if for Putin the war would be over, but for the military forces of the Russian state, it would probably be almost the maximum they can achieve throughout the summer. This grinding war of attrition you're talking about is really putting a toll, and really a lot of resources are spent by Russia to be able to control Luhansk. We're not even sure if Donetsk will be able to be controlled by the Russian forces by the end of the summer. We've seen a lot of strikes from the Ukrainian forces deep into Russian territory and Russian occupied territory, which underline that new military equipment given by the U.S. have made an important change in the tactical and the operational level during the war. So overall, what we can see is Donetsk Oblast in general and the Donbass represent the biggest achievement that the Russian military can really achieve in the coming months.
Do you expect, I know it's impossible to get into the mind of Vladimir Putin in that front, but do you anticipate or see any other targets for the Russian government? It doesn't appear like losses are much of an issue for it. Do you see any other major targets after the eastern Donbass as well, or the Donbass region?
I think technically in southern Ukraine, so in the region of past Kherson and Mykolaiv, as well as Odessa, we can expect Russia to try to push in that direction at some point. But it doesn't seem that they have the resources to do so, especially after Ukraine was able to retake the Snake Island in the Black Sea. Obviously, on the long run, Russia would like to control the entire coast of the Black Sea in order to increase the blockade on Ukraine. But I think it is wishful thinking at this point to think that Russia can do that.
I know we're all watching closely, but we'll leave it there for now. But Jean-Francois, thanks so much for your time this morning. I very much appreciate your perspective.
Thank you very much. Have a nice day.
You too. It's Jean-Francois Rattel, military expert, assistant professor in the U of O's Faculty of Social Sciences. Just keeping us up to date on the latest on Ukraine and the invasion by Russia as well as some commitments by NATO members as well. 30 NATO allies signing off on the process for Sweden and Finland to join the military alliance. So that's starting yesterday as well. Canada, one of the first ones to welcome Sweden on that front. So We'll see how this strains out, but it doesn't look like it's going to be going anywhere anytime soon in terms of the ongoing conflict in Ukraine. Still to come here on the show, we're going to chat more about Patrick Brown being kicked out of the Conservative leadership race last night by the party. He's being accused of some financial irregularities with some of his memberships for the party. Barry McLaughlin's going to join us in the 11 o'clock hour to talk about that a little bit more as well. What does this do for the Conservative leadership race? Does it turn it on its head? The Brown, Charest, Poilievre kind of top three, it looks like it's been so far. Does that now go to Charest, Poilievre, Leslyn Lewis? What does this mean for a second ballot in the race as well? Very interesting coming up as well. We've been chatting about the healthcare system this morning. Here in this province, we've seen ER closures, staffing shortages, other issues as we look like we're heading to another little wave here of COVID-19. Diane in Ottawa texts, during the Harper years, they sold houses to nurses that were coming back from the USA, California. They had an agency recruiting nurses at double the pay. They came back with enough money to buy a house. Today, what is different is why would anyone take up a nursing career seeing what is happening? Plus, expensive for schooling. Doctors would retire early. Young doctors will transfer to the U.S. And, you know, can you really blame them? If you're being offered, you know, double the money in another place to do the same job, what would you do? 10:45, just speaking on Ukraine, I just wanted to pass on that Ukraine's new ambassador will be visiting Eganville next Wednesday, so accept a check of $80,000 from a recent fundraiser in that community as well. So the Ottawa Valley also giving back to those in Ukraine as well. I take a quick break. When we come back, we'll chat a little bit more about that Conservative leadership race as well, a little more about the healthcare system here in Ontario. What's on your mind? Texas 580-580. Tweet us at CFRA Ottawa. I'm Andrew Princey. This is News Talk 580, CFRA.
You're listening to Ottawa at Work on News Talk 580, CFRA.
This is Ottawa at Work. I'm Andrew Pinson with you until noon today. Taking your text up until noon as well. Chatting about our healthcare system, would also like your thoughts on this change in the Conservative leadership race. A bombshell last night. Patrick Brown kicked out of the race. Party accuses him of some financial irregularities. Nothing been, I guess, proven at this point. They're just allegations at this point. And Patrick Brown's set to come up on the Evan Solomon Show at 12:20, so it'll be interesting to hear what he has to say as well. But your thoughts on that, welcome as well at 580-580. You can also tweet us at CFRA Ottawa. Ottawa and the Valley continuing to deal with a high number of overdose deaths as those have continued to rise since the start of the COVID-19 pandemic. Wendy Muckley is the co-founder and executive director of Ottawa Inner City Health. She spoke to Rosie Etta this morning on CTV Morning Live about this increase in overdose deaths.
Wendy, we got to talk about that we've seen an increase in overdoses in and around the city since the pandemic. Can we get to a more specific reason as to why that is happening?
So periodically we see spikes in overdoses, which unfortunately in this particular spike have resulted in an unusual number of deaths. But this typically is attributed just to the drug supply. As I'm sure you understand, this is an illicit drug supply that's being produced probably locally, and the quality of the drugs is not great in that the concentration is probably too high. From what I know from our overdoses, and we've certainly seen in the last 2 weeks, about a doubling of what we would normally see in terms of overdoses around the Byward Market area. And it appears that it's illicit fentanyl, which is the culprit, and it seems to be in everything. So people, you know, for example, people who thought that they were smoking pot had an accidental overdose. People who thought that they had done the usual amount of fentanyl that they would normally do, overdosing just because it's too strong. And we're also seeing it in the stimulant supply, which is really concerning. So people think that they're smoking crack or they're smoking crystal meth, but in fact they're smoking fentanyl and often don't have the tolerance to be able to use without overdosing. So it is really concerning.
Wendy, can you tell us about a new study this week which showed that those who are the poorest Canadians are really suffering from overdoses? What's in that new study?
So I have not seen the study myself, but this is not new information. It just validates what we already know. Unfortunately, you know, illicit drug use, overdoses, all of the harms that come from illicit drug use, those harms tend to be concentrated among our most vulnerable citizens. So people who are poor, people who are racialized, indigenous, people who've been criminalized, those are the people who get squeezed into the most dangerous parts of the illicit drug market. And unfortunately, those are the people who have a much higher chance of experiencing severe harms, including death from illicit drugs. This is unfortunately, you know, this is an unfortunate reality. We saw this, you know, a very similar thing with COVID. Anytime we have things that are harming our society, they disproportionately impact the people in our society that are most vulnerable.
Wendy, what are the laws surrounding those who use illicit drugs? If they are seen possibly overdosing on the streets, do they run the risk of being arrested as well?
So in theory, they should not be arrested. We have in Canada a Good Samaritans Act, and that should protect people and allow them to seek help in an emergency. Unfortunately, the Good Samaritans Act would probably help you or I, but for many of the people that I work with, there's a couple of reasons why it doesn't. The first and the most obvious is that they don't believe in it and they don't trust the police. So they don't believe that the police are going to follow the Good Samaritans Act. And even if they don't arrest them that day, that they'll come back later and arrest them. So that's a belief that's, you know, prevalent in the community. And so it does prevent people from seeking help. But also if people have outstanding warrants, and many people do, or if they're involved in the criminal justice system, the Good Samaritans Act doesn't apply. Mm. So it is not uncommon that, you know, if police are called and they do come and they will run the names of people, that they will pick up people on outstanding warrants. And that is a significant deterrent for people actually being able to seek help when they need it.
Wendy, we're up against the clock. I have one more question for you. Ottawa Inner City Health, how's your staffing, and do you need any more assistance in that department?
Oh, staffing is terrible. I mean, we have critical staffing shortages in every single program. You know, we have this horrible combination of, we have a large number of staff that are out with COVID. We have outbreaks in the shelter system, and unfortunately, those outbreaks also impact our staff. So we have a significant number of staff off on COVID. We have also a significant number of staff who are off on mental health leaves. The last 2 years has really taken a toll on everybody, and I think people know healthcare workers also were really impacted. Our staff have had to work long, long hours under really difficult conditions. And, you know, a lot of them just have not made it through. The trucker convoy had a huge impact. Some people, you know, managed to make it through all of the 2 years, but the trucker convoy was just one thing that, you know, too much. And so we have a lot of staff off, and we're not really able to recruit staff. Like most healthcare organizations, we're restricted by Bill 124 to the 1% increase. And so, you know, our salaries no longer match the market. And so it makes it really hard for us to even be able to recruit new people. So staffing is definitely a crisis right across the healthcare system.
Well, Wendy Muckle, we need you out there and the Ottawa Inner City Health doing what you do to help those in need. And I want to thank you very much for your time this morning.
Thanks so much, Rosie. Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
It's Wendy Muckle speaking with Rosie Etter this morning on CTV Morning Live, just talking about an increase in overdose deaths that they're seeing here in the city, how they're handling that as well. It's an issue that's been compounded by the COVID-19 pandemic as well as the number of other issues that she mentioned there. We've been talking about the healthcare system, as she mentioned, in general, when it comes to staffing and other issues. Your thoughts on the state of our healthcare system right now? Have we learned anything from the pandemic? It looks like, you know, we're dealing with staff shortages and a number of other of issues as we're on the precipice of perhaps another little wave of COVID-19 here ahead of the regular flu season in the fall. Are we ready? Do you think we're ready? Also, just checking in on your interactions with the healthcare system this morning, hearing of people with delayed surgeries and other issues as well. How has this been affecting you? Text us 580-580. Tweet us at CFRA Ottawa. We'll be right back here on Ottawa at Work after the news. This is News Talk 580 CFRA.
You're listening to Ottawa at Work on News Talk 580 CFRA.
11:07, this is Ottawa at Work. I'm Andrew Pinson with you until noon today. Lots of texts to continue to get to here. Talking about our healthcare system, dealing with staffing shortages, ER closures in a number of places as well. This ahead of an expected wave here late summer for COVID-19 that many experts say has already begun. Also got the fall flu season. Do you think we're ready? Text us 580-580, tweet us at CFRA Ottawa. How has the healthcare system been affecting you as well? A parliamentary committee this week has concluded that a number of groups have attempted to recruit members from the Canadian Armed Forces, this being right-wing extremist groups, as well as federal law enforcement. It's a problem that continues to exist as more, I guess, online rhetoric continues. Now, one of the people who have testified at this parliamentary committee discussing the issue of right-wing extremism in our military and our police forces is Professor Barbara Perry. She's with the Canadian Anti-Hate Network, and she's also a professor in the Faculty of Social Sciences and Humanities at Ontario Tech University. Good morning, Dr. Perry.
Good morning.
And thanks so much for joining us. Now, you testified as an expert before this committee, so just what have you seen that has led, I guess, right-wing extremism and right-wing extremist groups to target those within the Canadian Armed Forces or within our police forces?
Yeah, I think we've seen some very explicit calls for membership amongst the military and law enforcement from some of these groups. I mean, they're quite actively recruiting people from the military for a number of reasons. I think in large part because they think they can bring the expertise and the leadership and perhaps even the discipline that these actors need and that these groups seem to feel that they need to strategize in order to, as they would say, defend themselves and their country.
What do these groups get out of, I guess, attracting members from the Canadian military or from members of police forces?
Well, they potentially get those skills that I mentioned, but I think that there's also a sense, a belief at least, that having active and former military and law enforcement personnel lends some credibility, some legitimacy to the groups. You know, if these people who are, you know, meant to defend us and our rights, you know, agree with their narratives, then they must have something right. And I think that that's a worrying aspect of it.
And just in terms of, you know, we talk about right-wing extremism, we talk about it in general a lot of times, but just in talking about some of the, I guess, purveying right-wing groups in this country, we've seen some of them kind of come to the forefront and connect themselves to the Freedom Convoy, for example. Just in terms of some of the groups at play here, just what are you seeing in terms of, I guess, what's at play? You know, we've heard the Proud Boys, Diagolon, groups like that. What do you think is the biggest threat here in Canada?
Well, I think that there's two segments that are particularly worrying, and that is the militia or the Patriot movement, which, you know, model themselves very much on the American militia movements that are, you know, they're armed, they're trained, whether they're formally trained or just training in sort of paramilitary strategy, you know, they do have that capacity. And then we have the accelerationists, so the base in Attamwaffen that we've heard so much about in the last couple of years, and they are really intent on some form of civil war. You know, they're of the belief that the current government is, or order, I should say, not just the government, but the current political order is so corrupt, as they would say, tyrannical, that it's time for them to be overthrown. What they're going to be replaced with is an unknown there. But again, these are very aggressive. The accelerationists are very aggressive, very much involved in both promoting and engaging, willing to engage in violence themselves. And again, heavily armed. So I think those are the two areas that we need to worry about the most.
And just in particular, you know, we were talking about kind of a rise in some of these right-wing extremist rhetorics even before the COVID-19 pandemic. But it seems like some of these groups have kind of seized on, you know, some of these conspiracy theories and other kind of opposition to government public health measures to kind of rally members as well. How big of a, has the pandemic and some of those, I guess, conspiracy theories been for recruiting new members?
Oh, it's been a major boon for the movement that is they're able to draw people in through some of these conspiracy theories, through some of these broader ideas about, you know, government overreach or about, you know, bad science or about, you know, the implantation of microchips in the vaccine, all of those pieces to draw people in. So they use those narratives. And then, you know, once they're in the movement, they expand the narratives as well. And so they begin to talk about, you know, some of the older, more traditional discourses and grievances around immigration, around, you know, rights for minority and marginalized groups. So it is part of this process of recruitment and grooming.
Is it possible, you know, some of these people who are supporting groups like this, who are simply, you know, anti-vaccination and believe whatever conspiracy they want to about that, is it possible they don't really realize they're being an unwitting kind of participant here in another right-wing group to give it a kind of feel of support and legitimacy?
Yeah, I think that's, you know, for example, during the convoys in January and February,
right,
we're seeing a lot of that, folks being drawn in, unaware of what the broader context was for the groups that were trying to draw them in.
And I recently watched a great documentary on the HBO on Crave called 4 Hours at the Capitol, kind of looking at the January 6th riots. Just a lot of interesting footage coming from the front of that. What I thought was most interesting, though, was you had thousands of people on the front lawn of the Capitol having a party, very celebratory, talk about rights, very peaceful. But then, you know, feet away inside, you had people literally trying to kill police officers and the vice president and the Speaker of the House. Is that kind of the, I guess, dichotomy here, where you have this large tent, people are really intent on doing some serious harm, and then you have others that are just hangers-on?
Yeah, and again, we saw that with the convoys. You know, I would say the majority of the people were there, you know, with you know, authentic concerns about the vaccine. It wasn't about freedom. It wasn't about overreach. It was just about, you know, vaccines or perhaps lockdowns and having lost their jobs because of lockdowns, that sort of thing. But caught up in almost the hysteria of some of the far right narratives around, you know, those conspiracy theories and the idea that, you know, the current government is part of some broader international cabal intent on controlling all of our behaviors. So, yeah, I think, you know, again, very much unaware. But on the other hand, I'm going to say, you know, that party atmosphere, I think that was also intentional and quite purposive on the part of some of the leaders, that, you know, the bouncy castles and the hot tubs were, you know, one way to present this as a party atmosphere, as a friendly, you know, happy, joyful place. And you know, sort of present it that way, but also, you know, lure those unsuspecting folks in as well through that kind of representation of the protests and the convoys.
And just back on the issue of, I guess, in the Canadian Armed Forces, just do you think there is a concern if we continue to, you know, allow groups like this to actively recruit within our military and our police forces? Are we going to end up getting an issue, I guess, within the forces that perhaps we're kind of not prepared for?
Well, I think there are a number of problems. I mean, one is obviously, you know, the impact that has on the legitimacy and public perceptions of the military, but it also is worrisome in terms of, you know, when they're engaged in other countries, you know, even if they're there on a peacekeeping mission. If they go in with, you know, xenophobic narratives, if they go in with, you know, with anti-foreigner, we'll call it, I hate that term, but I'm going to, you know, non-white, non-Canadian, non-European others, will that influence the way that they respond or the way that they behave when they're in the field? And I think that's a major worry, that, you know, they're influenced very much by those ideologies in terms of perhaps less protective approaches to those that they're meant to defend.
Yeah, and I know it's an issue we'll continue to watch closely. But Barbara, thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
You're very welcome.
That's Dr. Barbara Perry, faculty of professor in the Faculty of Social Sciences and Humanities at Ontario's Tech University, also an expert in extremism with the Anti-Hate Network here in Canada. Your thoughts on that? Text 580-580, tweet us at CFRA Ottawa. I've been taking texts this morning on our healthcare system. Just wanted to get to a few of those as well. Get used to private healthcare. It's coming, says one texter. It's already in its heads here. Ontario will model BC and Quebec. Somebody sending along a link here for a private clinic in Toronto. And similarly to all the private clinics, even the ones we have here in Ottawa, right? They charge for OHIP services. Do a number of tests on that front. So we do see some of the, you know, private healthcare, but still not paid for out of our own pocket. But, you know, is this the stopgap that we need? Do we need more? Do we just need more people? How do we address this? And also, how is this affecting you? The healthcare system delays. Let us know. Text us 580-580, tweet us at CFRA Ottawa. I'm going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll chat more about Patrick Brown being kicked out of the Conservative leadership race. Some shocking news last night. Barry McLaughlin is the president of TLC Transformational Leadership Consultants. He's going to join us coming up after the break to talk about that and what this means for the federal Conservative leadership race ahead of that September election date. All of that and more coming up between now and noon here on Ottawa at Work. I'm Andrew Pinson. And if you can be
next to me, your memory. You're listening to Ottawa at Work on News Talk 580 CFRA.
11:22, welcome back. This is Ottawa at Work. I'm Andrew Pinson. We're expecting to hear directly from Patrick Brown today, the federal Conservative leadership candidate disqualified from the race last night. He's going to join Evan Solomon this afternoon at 12:20 here on News Talk 580 CFRA. So we'll get his reaction to that. But the chair of the CBC Leadership Election Organizing Committee says he won't have anything else to say about the decision. There were concerns about rules, finances, memberships, lots of kind of to talk about, I guess. Barry McLaughlin is the president of TLC Transformational Leadership Consultants, and he joins us on the phone this morning. Good morning, Barry.
Good morning, Andy. How are you?
Not too bad. How about you?
I hope you can hear me okay. I'm in Bar Harbor, Maine.
I saw some of the pictures. Very jealous of your vacation time this morning.
Yeah, yeah, we're at the Stephen King former home that's now a writer's retreat. That's pretty cool. Yeah, and we're on our way now to the ferry to go to beautiful Nova Scotia.
Oh, that's fantastic. And I hope you guys are enjoying yourselves. Do you see, in terms of, I mentioned on Twitter, the Stephen King kind of fitting, right? The horror show that is Patrick Brown's campaign right now. But just, were you shocked by this news last night? It seemingly came out of left field.
Well, you know, I'll just say this. Patrick Brown's had a lot of problems over the years. And even in his hometown where he's the mayor or was the mayor, you know, there are a lot of scuttlebutt of problems there. So that the fact that he's got himself in more trouble in this, honestly, it's not a complete shock to me. But, of course, the fact of being kicked out of the race is quite shocking in and of itself for any candidate. And, you know, you hear a lot of rumors, hearing everything from he's only got 75,000, not 150, that people were paying their membership apparently with prepaid credit cards, which is not legal and not allowed. And somebody else was a big funder of it all for the staff and not being declared. So these are all rumors right now, in fairness. We don't really know that, but this changes the dynamic in a number of ways.
And I guess even to your point, you know, even the party is saying these are serious allegations of wrongdoing that, quote, appear to violate Canadian election law. Just, do you think it's interesting that they chose to kick Brown out of the leadership race right now when they haven't seemingly, even themselves say they haven't, you know, verified these allegations?
Well, I think they have enough information. If they left it too long, he'd be on all the ballots. And, you know, try as you might, you pretty well, you know, created serious problems. Those votes could have gone elsewhere. That's one problem. I think the second is they've got to be, they got to be cleaner than clean. They have to act quickly when they get very serious information.
Right.
They can't be seen to have allowed it to happen. It will stain the whole party. So I think they did the right thing of moving quickly on this matter.
Yeah, it's a good point. Transparency, no matter what, it doesn't really look bad on that front. How this affects the race, we can get to, I guess, we'll see how these allegations kind of play out, but just how this affects the race in one way or another, does this pretty much, coronate Pierre Poilievre as a leader of the party, do you think?
I wouldn't necessarily say that. I mean, if you, understand the process, mm-hmm. a lot of those brown voters, apparently, the Sheree voters, were willing to, one to swap to the other as necessary on second ballot, so, or third ballot or whatever. So will Patrick Brown be able to influence his voters to go to Sheree is the question. I mean, he and Poilievre have pretty staked out pretty tough, a relationship between the two of them. And so it would have to be to Sheree. We just don't know, given all this, how many has he got left to leverage? Is it 75,000? Well, of course, Sheree would love 75,000 votes. So it could benefit him. That's a little bit of a conjecture at this point.
And just even to that point, I guess, the getting to a second ballot, do you think this would affect the, Sheree campaign the most in terms of that was kind of the hope is once you get past the first ballot that all of those second ballots would kind of give more support to the leadership candidate. But without Patrick Brown, does that kind of leave, the Jean Sheree campaign in limbo somewhat?
Well, I think, I think they were both safe for the first and second rounds. Mm. I think you're talking about third round, as the others start to drop out. So it may not happen that quickly, but now with Brown, apparently they started printing some of the ballots. So that'd be an interesting question mark. they got all to be consistent ballots. But anyway, if he's not on the ballot at all, people are free to vote wherever they want. You've got to assume that if you wanted Poilievre, you would have put him in your first ballot in the first place. I think Brown was always seen as a supplement to or support of or vice versa with Sheree. So I still think those numbers can go to Sheree. Now, is that enough to win? Who knows? I mean, we just don't know. All we know is that 310,000 ballots apparently have been, paid for the membership for Pierre Poilievre, which is exceptionally strong. This probably explains, by the way, why Patrick Brown started floating the idea that he would run for mayor. About a week ago.
Yeah.
What the heck was that all about? What? Well, I think we know what that was about.
Yeah, there's been there's been a lot of strange things going on in the background. Even Michelle Rempel-Garner leaving the campaign in the middle.
Yeah.
It's been a bit of a disaster.
Well, I'm still reading her resignation letter. It's taking me quite a while, but,
to even just understand what's trying to be said here. But on the last one, I guess, is it best for the Conservatives at this point to just try to move on from this as quickly as possible and deal with it and get on to the issue of picking a new leader and rallying around them?
Yeah, that's exactly true. I think they can't spend very much on this. They have to just sort of say, look, it happened. He's got to be accountable for his own behavior and all the conduct. But we're moving forward ourselves. I don't think you're going to get a lot of interviews done by the other candidates on him. And I think they want to turn the page on this and move rapidly.
Yeah, no question. We'll leave it there. Barry, thank you so much for your time this morning. I really appreciate it. And I hope you enjoy the rest of your time in Maine and Nova Scotia.
Thank you so much, Andy.
It's Barry McLaughlin. He's the president of TLC, Transformational Leadership Consultants. He's worked with many leadership candidates or politicians when it comes to preparing for the campaign or debates. Well, it's a great insight from Barry as well. But just a mess, really. There's no other way to put it here. At least for now, for the conservative leadership race. Maybe in a week or two, it's the summer. Maybe we forget about all of this, but I don't think Patrick Brown, based on his history, is going to go away without a massive fight on his hands. So we'll see how that plays out. Just a text here before the break. The great PC Party of Canada, again, a total mess. Patrick Brown kicked out of the party, nothing new. PCs are a terrible party. They change leaders, it seems, monthly. That's thanks from Dan. Just a minor correction, it is the Conservative Party of Canada. PCs only exist here in Ontario since that merger about, 22 years ago? Still playing out, I guess. 11:30, take a quick break from the news. Here on the other side, we'll chat a little bit more about that Patrick Brown disqualification from the federal leadership campaign. Take more of your text on our healthcare system. Lots more still to come here until noon on Ottawa at Work.
You're listening to Ottawa at Work on News Talk 580 CFRA.
11:35. This is Ottawa at Work. We're with you until the top of the hour, until noon here. As you heard in Chris Holsky's newscast, very interesting. Patrick Brown speaking out today on his disqualification from the Conservative leadership race and happening last night. You can hear that full interview coming up this afternoon at 12:20 here on News Talk 580 CFRA. And let us know what you think about that change. 580-580, tweet us at CFRA Ottawa. We'll hear a couple clips of that interview coming up in a few minutes as well. Just to pass along a little bit of breaking news, I guess we could call it. John Krupe passing along to the desk here. We were talking about inflation, home sales. Latest numbers from the Ottawa Real Estate Board showing residential home sales down 31% this year over last year. So the correction in the housing market clearly already underway with interest rates set to rise in a couple of weeks as well. Actually, less than a week. Let's see here. The 14th is when that announcement is made, next Thursday. So expecting interest rates to move higher. They're talking about how that could move us into a recession. Just lots of economic uncertainty left for the rest of 2022. So wanted to pass that along as well. And there was something else I wanted to pass along too. Oh, well, it'll come back to me. 580-580, tweet us at CFRA Ottawa. Let us know about the healthcare system as well. Been some concerns about that. Michael Cohen is the president and CEO of the Perth and Smiths Falls District Hospital. We spoke to him over the long weekend, talking about some of the staffing issues that they've been dealing with, forcing them to close their ER. That extension has now once again been closed. Has once again been extended. Because the staffing issue has continued. We've seen it happen at other hospitals across the province as well. We once again asked the Minister of Health, Sylvia Joynes, to join us today to talk about what the government is doing to address some of these issues. We asked last week as well. Last week, we got a statement that pointed to a number of investments in the healthcare system from previous budgets all the way back to 2020. Today, they've said they got our request. So nothing back in terms of a response or an interview or anything like that. But the healthcare system definitely in some turmoil right now. We're looking ahead to a possible fall wave of COVID-19 as well, or a late summer wave even is what many experts are predicting ahead of the fall flu season as well. Doesn't feel like our hospital system is ready for what's coming and what we know is coming. Have we learned anything from the rest of the pandemic? Kind of an important part too. You can text us at 580-580. Tweet us at CFRA Ottawa, your thoughts on that as well. And just checking here, the Ministry of Health working on our request. And we'll see over the coming weeks if we can have a chat with the new incoming health minister, Sylvia Joynes, to chat about the healthcare system and planning ahead as well for COVID-19 and some of the issues here. As I mentioned, it is Chris Holsky told you in the news. Federal Conservative leadership candidate Patrick Brown is speaking out today. He joined the Evan Solomon Show. Spoke to him this morning. That interview will air at 12:20 this afternoon. So definitely want to pay attention to that. Now, speaking with CTV, Brown saying the allegations that are levied against him are vague. His team wasn't given a fair opportunity to investigate, so he's firing back as well, saying that the Conservative Party clearly wants Pierre Poilievre to win. That's his thought on this. Here's a little bit of what he had to say.
Frankly, if Pierre Poilievre was going to win this race, if he had gone through a fair leadership contest, he would have a stronger standing afterwards, post-September 10th. But I also know that I was a candidate that called Pierre out. And I don't think his campaign liked that. I don't think the party establishment liked that.
That's Patrick Brown speaking to Evan Solomon. That full interview airing at 12:20 this afternoon, coming up in about 40 minutes time. So stay tuned for that. The Evan Solomon Show between 12 and 2 today. Very interesting to see the impact this will have on the Conservative leadership race and the opposition in general. Interesting. We have a CFRA Live Sunday political panel every Sunday here on CFRA Live, as many listeners will know. But one of our conservative panelists is Tasha Carradine, longtime commentator, principal at Navigator. She's now the author of a book looking at the conservative movement in Canada. And full disclosure, she does work with the Jean Charest campaign. But just interesting to see the some within the party just you know, wanting to go in one direction and others wanting to go in another. And we've seen the party go in a certain direction over the last few leadership races and elections, and it just hasn't gone well. So I just, you wonder how many times you're going to do the same thing over and over and over again before you realize what you need to do. Now, all of the leadership candidates at this point, those who win the race, they end up coming back to the, you know, somewhat to the center. Aaron O'Toole really tried to do that in that aspect. It didn't work, even though he did have some support on that front. So it just, it feels like the party continues to be in an identity crisis since it first merged back in the early 2000s, and it's still trying to figure that out. But, you know, I think it's really at the damage to Canadians, right, in our policy. We don't have a good opposition. You know, one that's not just saying we're going to do everything different, everything the opposite of what we're going to do. Freedom. Getting control back to Canadians. Other than just like repeating bumper stickers, actually do something to get positive policy change. And the Conservatives, for their part, have not been a major force in our governing for the last, what, 7 years? Because they've been mired in their own navel-gazing, I guess. It's just, you know, it must be frustrating for some people in the party telling them over and over again to need to stop doing this and try another way. To just have the same thing happen over and over again. Fascinating to see how this one will all square out as well. But once again, that interview coming up with Patrick Brown, or between Patrick Brown and Evan Solomon, coming up here at 12:20. So stay tuned for that here on News Talk 580 CFRA. Some other political talk also happening in the UK as well. UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson saying he's not going anywhere, but some cabinet ministers have already left, and a group of cabinet ministers, the BBC now reporting, are about to tell Boris Johnson to resign. So could his days be numbered? He's the prime minister in the UK as well. Very interesting. Adding to our very deep discussion on the state of politics in Canada. Text here. What the hell are you talking about? The Liberals are the ones spewing out bumper sticker BS. You suck. Our deep, deep conversations that are happening. Do you notice that we were talking about the Conservative Party, not the Liberals? And talking about the Conservative Party's inability to win an election in the last 7 years through multiple leaders. I don't think that has anything to do with the Liberals. You may want to check the mirror a little bit on that front. Liberals have just been really benefiting from the Conservatives being in chaos. What other way can you put it? We don't have an effective opposition in this country. And it's a problem. But we're not going to, you know, get our way out of inflation with cryptocurrency and all of this just insane stuff that, you know, Polyev has put to his supporters as well. That's not going to work. It's just trying to measure back here and get on back a normal conversation or debate. And just quickly here before the break, just another text on our healthcare system. We've been chatting about that this morning as well. Ontario healthcare is an embarrassment thanks to Doug Ford. Why are Ford and the new Minister of Health hiding? They've had time to improve it, but blew it by giving Ontario nurses a 1% increase. This is what a loser party the PCs are. No wonder nurses are quitting. That's Dan from Orleans. Just the loser party stuff. It sounds like Trump stuff, right? We can have a conversation without calling people losers. And it goes for both sides. I have to get people to stop calling Doug Ford a loser or Justin Trudeau a moron, because how does that help us in any kind of way? We can talk about ineptness and competence, but come on, we can get past the schoolyard stuff. 11:44. This is Ottawa at Work. We're going to take a quick break. We're going to hear more about the economy and how we're being affected. Big R word being thrown around, recession. What could the rest of 2022 look like heading into 2023? As I just mentioned, home prices just out for the month of June here in Ottawa, down 30%.